We had a lively interest in whatever the administration was doing with respect to church and state.
This is something that we fought hard for.
Religious liberty is one of the hallmarks and part of the bedrock of American democracy.
We at the BJC like to say when anyone's religious liberty is threatened, everyone's religious liberty is at risk. Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. I'm Amanda Tyler, Executive Director of the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty, and I'm pleased to be joined today by my friend and strong ally in advocacy, Tim Delaney, President and CEO of the National Council of Nonprofits. Welcome to the BJC podcast, Tim.
Thanks, Amanda. I'm delighted to be here and spend some time talking about one of our favorite issues that's consumed a lot of time.
That's right. We've been hard at work on a particular legislative priority here in Washington. We are trying to protect a longstanding law that protects charitable nonprofits, houses of worship, and foundations from the rancor of partisan politics. Some people refer to this law as the Johnson Amendment, and we've seen a lot of threats to it over the last year. Right now in Washington, the representatives and senators who work on appropriations are working on federal spending for the budget, and we expect this action to be continuing into March. And one thing that they could be considering is adding language that might undermine the Johnson Amendment. So to lead off, we want to talk about why we've been working so hard to protect this law. Tim, from the perspective of the nonprofit community, why is this law that prevents partisan campaigning an important protection?
Well, from our vantage point on the charitable nonprofit side of the house, there's probably 1,000 different reasons why we want to keep existing law and protect it. But we don't have time this morning to go over 1,000 different reasons. So the way I view it is we have been out there in a very caustic and partisan world, and people are tired of it. And going to our houses of worship and our charitable nonprofits is a way to escape all the rancor that you mentioned. From the individual perspective, then to the nonprofit perspective, the Johnson Amendment has shielded us for 60-plus years, and it's protected us from being sucked into partisan politics, and has allowed us to focus on our missions. And then from a citizen's perspective, the existing law, as we see it, has kept billions of dollars of secret dark money from flooding into and through our religious and charitable organizations. And that would mean that, among other things, that we as people would have a much smaller voice in the policymaking process in our country.
Well, I think those are excellent points and things that we definitely see in the context of houses of worship, too. One common misconception about attempts to change the law is this would only impact houses of worship, and your partnership and the partnership of National Council of Nonprofits has been so important to say this is not something that would impact just houses of worship, but all organizations that claim 501c3 status. But that idea of really injecting partisan divisions and rancor into our community spaces is really important in the context of houses of worship. And for those who are listening, who are just kind of joining the conversation, thought it might be helpful for us to do a quick year in review to talk about all the different places we've seen this issue popping up. We've got a graphic of this timeline on bjconline.org. You can go to the website and see the timeline there. But really, just over a year ago, I think, is when this popped onto the national scene, when President Trump at the National Prayer Breakfast made this statement about his intent to change the law. Let's take a listen.
I will get rid of and totally destroy the Johnson Amendment and allow our representatives of faith to speak freely and without fear of retribution. I will do that. Remember.
So just after this comment in early 2017, we really sprang into action immediately to let people know the broad opposition across the nonprofit sector to this proposed change. Can you talk a little bit about what you all helped organize last spring in 2017?
Well, you say that we sprung into action. I think all of us did independently. In fact, that very day, our organization issued a press statement saying that this was not a problem. We needed to come together. And after we made that press statement, we then turned internally and did some deep, fast analysis and then reached out to our network, which is the largest network of charitable nonprofits across the country with more than 28,000 members. To hear what people were thinking, and it was a resounding, don't change existing law, protect the protection. And so we then developed what we called the Community Letter on Nonpartisanship that allowed individual organizations to sign on to a common letter to tell Congress, keep existing law, that shield that keeps partisan politics away from our operations is important. Don't mess with it. And so we then launched a campaign with charitable nonprofits and with foundations, and more than 4,400 signed it within a month, and we were able to then deliver that to Congress to tell them, don't be fooled. This is not wanted. Unfortunately, during the same time period, as you mentioned, the president made that pronouncement, and then that same day, there were a couple of bills introduced in Congress that would do what he was proposing. So we saw that it was an orchestrated effort and that we needed to speak in a unified voice. And along the way, we bumped into you as you were doing some of your great advocacy work, and you just sent out a kind of vibe that was really about the issue that kind of drew us in to say, gee, can we partner? Because we wanted to be part of your action. And we saw the important role that the religious community could play, needed to play, and as the point, but that we could then broaden it to explain this is not just an attack on religion, it's also an attack on charitable nonprofits and foundations and the communities that we serve.
And that has been so valuable. You know, the BJC worked on this issue now about 15 years ago, because when we first saw attacks to the law coming up, they really were focused just on houses of worship and allowing houses of worship to engage in political activity. As you mentioned, the bills that we've seen introduced now would apply to the entire sector. But because BJC had worked on this issue previously, we had already identified other religious and denominational organizations that cared a great deal about protecting the law. So we were able to go back to those groups and to even bring in more groups. And also in April of 2017, we released a letter of 99 religious and denominational organizations that were in support of current law. And I think that sends a strong signal about where the broad religious community is on this issue. And again, to date, not a single denominational organization has come out in favor of changing the law. So we definitely have the weight of the religious community on our side of this issue.
Well, you mentioned 99 groups originally signed that powerful letter, and I know that more people have signed yours, so can you brag on how many now? Are you still below 100?
No, now we're at 106, and we are continuing to accept groups that are, you know, learning about this issue and want to join forces. You know, we are continuing to update that letter and share it with Congress. And following your fabulous example with givevoice.org and the community nonprofit letter, we also around the same time launched faith-voices.org, which is a platform for faith leaders, both clergy and laity, to add their support for current law and to talk about what that what a change in the law would do to their religious communities. And to date, more than 4,300 faith leaders from across the country have signed on to that effort. And it's ongoing, as I know, Give Voices as well. So,
and so you actually have two active letters out there. One is for denominational and religious organizations, and the other is for individual leaders to sign, correct?
That's right.
And then with our letter, where we now have over 5,600 organizations have signed from all 50 states across the nonprofit community, very small organizations to very large organizations, from the Ford Foundation to local all-volunteer groups. It's been amazing how people have come together to lift their collective voice. And it was, I think, especially powerful when you were filing your letters with Congress and we were doing the same to just show this amplification of voice. It was pretty cool. And I was impressed by the wide breadth of the campaign. Now, that was some of the things that we were doing along the way. Also in April, the president had been hearing about this, and then in May, early May, he issued an executive order that some have said pretended that it was dealing with the Johnston Amendment, along with some other things. The executive order was challenged in court, and ultimately the Department of Justice, as you know, made a filing saying, well, it really didn't change the law because it's just an executive order, and the law that it would change is actually a statute that Congress passed in 1954, and President Eisenhower signed it. It was then updated in 1987 when President Reagan made the law even stronger by signing it. And so there's been a long history, and the Department of Justice had to concede that the executive order didn't change anything.
That's right, because, you know, the president can impact in some ways how it's enforced through the agencies, but cannot actually change the law, of course, that remains with Congress. And we've seen several attempts by Congress over the past year, and those continue to try to change the law, whether it's a full repeal or scale back on its enforcement, or other kinds of ways to limit its impact.
Well, and I think it's important for us all to take a step back and look how they did that. While there were a couple of bills that were freestanding by themselves attacking the nonpartisanship protection in the Johnston Amendment that's, again, been in place for six decades, when they really saw the wide opposition, it forced them to then go somewhat underground. And they then took these provisions to harm what we're trying to protect and attached this issue that has nothing to do with the budget, but then the House put it onto an appropriations bill and slipped it in there as a rider. And they did that in the summer and then passed it in the fall. Fortunately, the Senate didn't do anything with it. That appropriations bill was dead on arrival, according to several senators. But then they did it again by attaching it, or trying to attach it to the tax bill. And in fact, they did attach it to the House version of the tax bill, and it went over to the Senate.
That's right. And we really have seen very little debate on this in Congress. And that's because, again, as you mentioned, it's been tacked on to much larger pieces of legislation. So at most, we'll get 10 to 15 minutes of conversation on the issue, often, you know, after hours, late at night. And so there really hasn't been a chance for full public hearing of the issue. I think one of the longest debates we saw was last summer in one of the subcommittees of the Appropriations Committee. And we heard there Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz of Florida talk about why she was personally opposed to any kind of language trying to limit the bill. And I say personally because she spoke not only as a representative of her people, but she said in her speech as a Jewish member of Congress, and why from her religious perspective she was particularly troubled by the bill. I think it would be helpful to hear some of what she said there in that debate.
Absolutely.
Current law reflects the importance of this independence by striking a careful balance. Houses of worship with tax-exempt status are permitted to engage in political advocacy. They just can't tell people who to vote for. So it's no surprise that hundreds of religious organizations and faith leaders oppose Section 116 of this legislation out of an understandable concern that political parties and candidates seeking power would be empowered to use their congregations as tools and pressure them for endorsements.
Whenever this issue has been polled or put to public survey, overwhelming majorities are in favor of current law and against any attempts to change it or to inject partisan campaigning into their 501c3 organizations. We've seen this when asked particularly about houses of worship, that the numbers are 70% to 80% usually, and the majority oppose changing the law regardless of who they voted for, where they live in the country, what religious organization they are. Strong majorities are against any change. And it's interesting when clergy are asked if they support endorsing candidates from the pulpit, their opposition numbers are even higher. Usually it's around 90% of clergy are opposed to endorsing candidates from the pulpit. And there are a lot of reasons behind that. I think they know the kind of divisive impact they would have on, that would have on their faith community. I think they also know that's not where they want their focus to be, that they're not a pack and they don't want to be a pack. For the people in the pews, they don't want to be told who to vote for by their faith leader. They also know that even under current law, there's no threat to their tax-exempt status, talking about issues. And so when the question is asked, do you want to endorse a candidate, they say no. They know and that they can still talk about issues, about moral issues, about all of those kind of hot-button topics of the day that they want to speak with a strong prophetic voice on. They can certainly do that without risking their tax-exempt status. I think that's why we see such strong majorities supporting current law.
Well, and I've been so impressed by some of the arguments that I've been reading from the clergy who have been writing op-eds and letters to the editor to say, our job is to be helping people communicate with their creator and look at the issues of the day. It's not our job to tell people how to vote. And because we've been so impressed by those arguments and others, on the givevoice.org website you mentioned, it's www.givevoice.org, we've tried to capture those op-eds and statements from organizations from across the country so that all Americans can go to it and see the facts, see the opinions. And some of the, from the nonprofit perspective, it sounds like it's just like in the religious houses of worship. We don't want to be divided. We don't want to have in our boardroom someone who was in a sorority with one mayoral candidate and someone else who is in the fraternity of another mayoral candidate who are running against each other, and having that divisiveness in the boardroom as people are fighting and struggling. No, we need to endorse Sally. No, we need to endorse Fred. And it's like, where's the mission? Where's the focus on the mission? And so we just see how divisive and disruptive that will be to the work in the community. I remember a public official that I know quite well talked about the need for bipartisanship. And he said, you know, if my appendix burst and I'm being rolled into the emergency room or I have a heart attack, I don't stop the doctor or the surgeon at the door and say, are you Republican or Democrat? I just want to have the best who can provide the services. And it's sort of like this. Nonprofits are out there providing basic services in their local communities. And we don't want to be divided, whether it's a mayoral candidate or a presidential candidate or someone for Congress or someone from Dog Catcher. Can you imagine being in a boardroom and having to go through each and every candidate on the ballot and have to decide who you're going to be endorsing? Where's the mission?
And I think the divisiveness is certainly a theme that we've both seen. And the other theme that I've seen is the importance for independence and being, you know, our organizations in our sector, houses of worship, charitable nonprofits, private foundations, they're all pretty much held in very high esteem in the community. And part of that is because they're not seen as partisan. They're seen as above the fray. And they really are concerned about being labeled as partisan in a way that taints them.
Absolutely. And as soon as we lose public trust, we lose everything. And so we've got to maintain that public trust. And politicians may not know how much they've lost the public's trust, but charitable nonprofits and houses of worship and foundations certainly know how much we depend on public trust, and we want to protect what we have. Now, speaking of protection, how do you see this coming up this year? This is not just an historical conversation on what happened, but what do you see happening and how might this come up again? Will it be in a freestanding bill or somewhere else?
Well, one can never tell with Congress, of course, but I think we've seen such overwhelming opposition to this idea that it won't move as a freestanding bill. There may be continued attempts to tack it on to other must-pass legislation. You know, we saw a really concerted attempt to put it into the tax bill that failed. The attempt to include it failed at the last minute right before that large tax bill passed in December. We are anticipating a similar effort to add it to what's called the omnibus spending bill that, as of now, must pass by March 23rd. And so we are watching very closely and also encouraging people to raise their voice now and talk about why they're opposed to any change in the law to try to keep it out of that bill that's moving through Congress right now.
And as advocates, we know that, unfortunately, a lot of people start thinking, well, the deadline is when I should call my elected official, understanding how much the public official probably doesn't answer the phone or read the email. It's somebody else, and it takes a while for that to then generate up. And once the public official sees that they're receiving hundreds of calls against something or thousands of emails, then they start seeing this trend and they go, oh my gosh, I need to pay attention to this. And so now is the time for people to be calling your two United States senators and your United States representative and tell them to protect nonpartisanship and stop any anti-Johnson Amendment language that they're trying to sneak through in the spending bill.
So people can certainly call their representative or their senators at any point. We will also be organizing some coordinated call-in days for action. And to get more information on those, I hope you'll subscribe to our newsletter and to get e-action alerts at bjconline.org. Tim, do you have a similar action alert network that people might want to sign up for?
Sure. There are actually two. One is, again, the www.givevoice.org, where we will post action items. And then people can also go to our organization's website, which is www.councilofnonprofits.org. Again, councilofnonprofits.org. Where people can see not only what our organization is doing, but they can then click on a map on that website to then see what their state association of nonprofits is doing on the issues.
And givevoice.org and faith-voices.org are both still live petitions. We are still accepting additional signers and would encourage people, if they have not signed yet, to please go on and add their support. And that's another way to stay informed about what's happening. Well, thank you so much, Tim, not only for joining us today for the BJC podcast, but for your leadership and ongoing partnership and advocacy. We could not have had the success that we had last year on this issue without you, and really grateful for all that you've done.
Thank you. Together we can.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for joining us today for the BJC podcast. For more, you can visit our iTunes channel or our website, bjconline.org.